Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Anne and Peter Haig. And today we're going to take you back to London.
We are, but it's London with a difference.
Yes, we're going to do a little spicing up with the choices of restaurants in London.
A lot of people think British food is very bland. But in fact, that's really not true, and especially
if it's not British,
in the capital of London, is a worldwide center of some very interesting spicy cuisine, and we're going to cover three fine restaurants in this category that we visited in alphabetical order: Koya, Dock Kitchen, and Quilon. Just in case you're wondering why they're in the order they are, and then we're going to wish somebody a happy birthday. But a very unusual happy birthday. You'll have to wait to hear the segment about that, because you'll want to know what this little joke I played on you means. And then finally, we're going to visit with authors who revisited their growing up in France in the same circumstances but a decade apart, and how they revisited that and bringing it to you as a wonderful travelogue and foodologue, if you like, through the country of France from Paris to Provence. So that's today's program, and without underway, let's get going with
Koya.
Koya, a newly opened Peruvian restaurant with an Indian chef. Well, let's just hear the story.
Well, we've been trying to get a hold of Sanjay Dwivedi for how long now, Sanjay? You were the head chef at Koya. And it was one of our most wonderful experiences in London. The food at Koya is Peruvian, and it's very special because the owner of the restaurant and you, the head chef, are both Indian trained, although you've cooked many cuisines, have you not?
Yes. I mean, I started my career cooking French and Italian food, and just by instance, I started cooking about 10 years ago at Zaika, which was first Indian restaurant to have a Michelin star. I was only going to stay there for like 5 months, and I stayed there for nearly 10 years. And then I got an opportunity. I felt like, okay, now I need to do something different. And now I'm doing something with Peruvian food, and I'm loving it.
Now, you spent time in South America and also in Spain to prepare for this, right?
That's correct, yeah. I was in South America for nearly 2 months and Madrid for quite a while as well. And, so that was a good build. Learning curve for me, that's for sure.
What is the essence of Peruvian cuisine? Now, we had ceviche, but what else?
The beauty of Peruvian food, and I think that's why people are loving it as well. Just a mixture of Japanese, Chinese, Spanish, African, Italian food. Because all those cultures, put them in art, and they've just taken the best elements and just developed it to their cuisine. So, for example, like the ceviche, which I like to say is the new sushi, you know, instead of using wasabi and soya, Peruvians use lime juice and chili. So I say, and they've adapted the Japanese cuisine to their own taste. On top of that, like ceviche is like obviously the basis, and then on top of that, you also have anticuchos, which is grilled skewered meat. And again, Peruvian food is all about using different type of chili. So they have chilies for a lot of different things. So they have ají amarillo, they have ají panca, ají mirasol, ají limo, and they're all of different strengths and different fruitiness as well. So like, for example, ají amarillo is the yellow chili. It's, for me, probably one of the best chilies in the world.
Yeah, you said that. The chilies is amazing, all these chilies.
I mean, ají amarillo is like, it's got its own taste, and it's very fruity as well. And that is why, I use kilos and kilos of that stuff every day.
Do you have a supply problem, Sanjay? I mean, where do you get them from?
I've got a very good Peruvian supplier who brings me all the chilies. But as we speak, I've taken a piece of land and they are growing some chilies for me. They're growing some choclo, which is the white corn, which you might, I don't know if you remember on your trip, you had it with the ceviche as well. It's a corn which is like three times the size of a sweet corn, and it's really, really meaty.
Someone's growing this. So, this is in England, Sanjay, right?
That's correct, yeah. Okay. It's like about 100 kilometers away from London.
Ah, wonderful.
So this farmer who's just growing Rakatai, which is like a Peruvian black mint. So yeah, I mean, like nobody, because we are so busy and it's been such a success, thank you to all our lovely customers we've had in the past, we can afford to go and buy a piece of land and just grow our own stuff. And I believe, truly, truly believe in not doing this carbon printing.
Tell me this. Talk to us about, we love the Papa Seca.
Oh, yes. Right.
That was fabulous.
The Jews of God, they're the ones who came up with the potatoes. They have 5,000 different type of potatoes available. And one of the things in the good old days was they used to dry the potatoes so that they can use it in the winter times. And it's amazing because, like, when I first saw it, and when I first even ate it in Peru, it was like a very weird sensation. It's like it tasted very much like an earthy potato, but they used a lot of spices to it as well. And that is something which I did not like. So I came up with a few things, and like at the moment, like what we're doing is, because asparagus, broad beans are, and summer truffles are in season. So I'm just using same potatoes, you soak them overnight, and then you cook it with some ají panca and some oregano, and lots of asparagus and lots of broad beans.
Well, of course, another thing.
I think when you came to me, I think that time we had the winter truffles in season, so I was doing it with lots of wild mushrooms and winter truffle.
Well, we loved it. And also, tell us, quinoa is very typical of Peruvian. It's a Peruvian product. And you made the best.
It's a quinoa year, they say.
You made the best
quinoa.
It's a
year of the quinoa, yes. Yes.
That I ever had, and with coriander, mint, and pomegranate. What was wrong with that? Nothing. I loved it.
Oh, good. Yeah, again, you know, like, it's one of my best-selling salads, really. I mean, I would say about 50% of people who come to me always have these, the quinoa salad. And it's, again, it's healthy. And now quinoa on its own is such a beautiful, it's got a really nice texture as well. So I don't like to play with it. So all I do is I just put lots and lots of herbs and some tamarind, and that's it. Keep it simple.
Well, you don't feel strapped in any way by tradition. We had also a ceviche that was corvina, truffles, ponzu, and chives. Now that's your own creation, right?
Yes, correct, yes. Again, corvina is a very Spanish fish. It's mostly used by the Peruvians also, the Spanish Peruvians in Madrid and in Barcelona. And it's a very meaty fish. It's the same family as the sea bass. But again, it's got that Japanese influence to this particular ceviche.
You have beef, chicken, you have seafood, and the thing that was the most unusual thing I probably have ever had was, and I don't even like dessert, I had a corn sundae.
Oh, yes, I remember you when you saw that, and you were just blown away by that, yeah. Again, you know, it's that's what I love doing as well, it's playing with the different cultures. Now, Peruvians are known for corn. They love corn.
Right.
So I said, okay, what do I want to eat with corn? I have so much, because I use so much corn in here, and I've got all this husk. What can I do, which is something very clever, and something which people are going to say, nice. So I came up with a corn sundae. Again, we use a husk. We infuse the husk with milk overnight. So you have the milk, all taste, and the cream taste of all of the corn, and then we make an ice cream out of that.
And popcorn.
And just, exactly, and then just. And it's, again, it's a beautiful combination with pineapple as well. So it's like having a sundae, but with the flavor of corn. And corn is very sweet anyway.
Yeah, well, Anne, I've cured Anne with the corn sundae. And if I can ever remind myself to do this, I need to put Anne eating dessert on our website, because she
it's unusual.
She always tells people that she never does.
It's funny that you say that now, because at the moment, the sun is not shining today, but what we are doing at the moment is, because the summer berries are in season, so I'm doing another dessert, which is like, Peruvians use purple corn, and again, it's, they don't eat it, they only use to have a drink. So on the basis of that stock, which you get from the Peruvian corn, I've just created this beautiful dessert, which is like a summer berry soup with this corn syrup in there, with the corn, purple corn granite. So next time when you come in the summer, I'm definitely going to let you taste this lovely dessert.
Well, I see only one problem for our listeners, and I guess in a way it's a problem for you, except you're laughing all the way to the bank. The problem is people are going to hear this interview, and then they're going to have the challenge of being able to get a reservation.
Oh, Lord, it's okay. But come for lunch.
Yeah. So
Lord, and I love, you know, personally, on a personal note, I'm a person who likes to go to a restaurant. Whenever I travel as well, or even in London, I always go for lunch. And I'll tell you for why. Two reasons. Quieter. Number two, you have the whole day to digest the food.
And you will inevitably eat far far more than you should have, because it all tastes so good.
Oh, thank you so much. That's very kind, yeah.
Sanjay, it was one of the best meals I've ever had, so I loved it.
And you've been open...
Thank you so much. I remember you so well as well, and I remember how much you went into that food as well. And it's great to talk to you guys. It really is.
And you better get ready for those 350 people who are coming for dinner tonight. So.
No, exactly. I know.
So thank you.
But yeah, we already started. It's all going left, right, and center. It's, what's the time now? And it's 6:30, and yeah, the restaurant is...
Buzzing.
Buzzing, yeah.
Okay, well,
it's great. I love it. Love it.
Continued success to you, and hopefully we'll get back soon. And just
no. Hopefully, I am going to see you soon for sure.
Okay. And I miss
you. Definitely, I'm going to look forward to seeing you again.
Thank you so much, Sanjay.
Thank you so much, Peter. I'm sending you lots of regards and lots of love, and I'll see you soon.
Okay, ciao, Sanjay.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Bye. Adios. Adios.
Adios.
So if you think this is a place we're recommending, yes we are. Go there before it gets to be so busy you can't get in. And as Sanjay suggested, going at lunchtime would be a great idea. We had lunch from about 2 o'clock until about 4:30 in the afternoon. It's a great way to spend half a day. And now we'll be back with another exciting spicy restaurant right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay. Welcome back. And I'm sure that listening to this next interview, you're going to be as surprised by this place as we were. It's Doc. What's the name of it?
Doc Kitchen. It's an unusual place. It's a combination of a fine restaurant and a kitchen design store. The chef is originally Irish. The last name Paul is Irish. We didn't realize that. And he cooks mostly.
Yeah, because it came originally. I think it was from French.
Could be. Or it could have been Spanish. I mean, some Spanish people landed in Ireland in 1588 as they were running away with the Spanish Armada. So who knows who it might have been. But Steve's been around the world collecting wonderful ideas for spicing up a cuisine and making some very, very interesting things. And it's an interesting place to visit and hang out as well. So here's Stevie from Doc Kitchen.
We just learned that Stevie Paul is, that's not a French verb in any form. He is, in fact, an Irish name. And he has this wonderful restaurant that we just had lunch in called Doc Kitchen. Tell me, Stevie, first of all, where does the name come from? I mean, I know since I saw it, but tell our listeners why you call your restaurant Doc Kitchen.
Well, firstly, there's a kitchen. And a kitchen. Kitchen for me is a lovely word for a restaurant. I think always think it implies some kind of homeliness that is sometimes missing from the sort of more fine dining kind of restaurant experience. And then, of course, dock, because we are in an old Victorian dock next to the canal in northwest London.
Which is gorgeous. It's just so charming, the whole location. And you have the restaurant and bar on one floor, and then downstairs you have the kitchen shop.
Yep, so downstairs there's also some kind of takeaway lunches, and we have a cocktail depth bar down there the weekends in the evening, and then there's a furniture shop which has some homewares as well. My restaurant is a collaboration with a furniture designer called Tom Dixon.
Right.
And he's one of the great British furniture designers, so he has a shop below which sells some of his furniture, and also some things that he's sourced particularly for this site.
And you have a beautiful deck looking over the canal, which is surprisingly tiny canal. It's really
canals were always quite narrow, actually, and that's why those boats that go on the canal are only 5 feet wide.
Well, the funny thing is, here in the United States, you have canals like the St. Lawrence Seaway, and then the Panama Canal and the Suez Canal, which are kind of a little bigger.
Yes, exactly.
So the Grand Union Canal, which is, I think, the end of which you sit on.
That's right.
Imagine, listeners, that you feel like you could jump across it.
Yeah, and it's not deep either. You know, that's bigger than the road, the canals in England.
Now,
Yeah, no, I have.
One of the remarkable things, in last week's program, played an interview with Luke Thomas, and you and Luke have a credential in common. I think you must know Luke, and you were in a sense were his leader along the way, because a couple of years ago you were the Observer Food Monthly Young Chef of the Year.
That's right. Yeah, I won that in 2010.
How come? I mean, you were like 18 or 19 years old. How did you become so skilled so quickly?
Well, you started cooking when you were 16, right?
Yeah, I started when I was 16, and actually I'm now 28, so I was 24 when I won that award, which was a really brilliant award for me to win. I was incredibly excited because as a chef, you know, particularly when you're just starting your own thing, you have your head down quite a lot and you're really just sort of, it can be quite introspective and you're sort of focusing on what you're doing really, really hard. And actually when someone get a great review or you get an award or something like that, it's really important actually.
Now you've cooked at some interesting places. If we're trying to pinpoint the influences on your style, you cooked at the River Cafe,
yeah.
Moro, which is Spanish, and then Petersham Nurseries. What did you get from those places?
Well, I think the biggest influence of my cooking was working at River Cafe.
Right.
And one of whilst I don't actually cook all that much Italian food anymore, my food is much more eclectic. There's a simplicity and a confidence and a focus on ingredients that I learned at River Cafe, which I think I can never lose. I think it will always be with me. And then I learned at Moro, the food is Spanish, but also it's Moorish, so it goes to North Africa and to the sort of nearer parts of the Middle East as well. So that started to push my food a little further east. And then at Petersham, I worked with Skye Gingell, who's an Australian chef, and she cooks much more freely in terms of ingredients, that kind of Australian cooking tradition that is much more free with its flavourings. But the biggest influence, I think, on my food, apart from those restaurants, is travel, and I do travel a lot.
Well, you never know, picking up your menu, what to expect, because you do have a very wide-ranging selection of dishes and ingredients, and particularly a sensibility for spicing. Talk to us a little bit about some of these dishes. Now, we had chicken livers cooked in 7 spices and pomegranate molasses with lavash.
That's right. So that's one of the dishes that doesn't come off the menu, actually. It's one of the things that I change my menu every day, pretty much. But that, if I take that off the menu, then all the regulars complain, so I have to put it back on again. But that's something that I ate in Beirut, in Lebanon, and I read it on the menu, and I thought, oh, goodness, that sounds great. And I could imagine in my mind how I'd cook it. And then I got it, and it was really disgusting. The liver was really sort of chewy and gray, and the pomegranate was incredibly acidic and not very tasty, and there wasn't much spice in there. But it was an interesting lesson, I think, in terms of what I do here, which is take things from different places around the world and change them and adapt them to my style. So now we have this sort of very quickly cooked, lovely pink livers with a complex and punchy spice mix, a delicious organic pomegranate molasses, which is, of course, the juice of pomegranates that's boiled and boiled until it's sweet and sour and sticky.
I loved
it. And then we finish that with a little bit of yogurt just to give a kind of cleanness to it, to sort of go against that syrup and also that sort of quite round aromatic spice.
Now, what did you do to fix up the lamb biryani? Was it lamb we had? Yes.
Yeah, it was lamb. And what we buy a lot of our meat, whole animals from farmers. So first of all, what we do is we choose lamb, or in fact hoggart, which is an older animal that, you know, really well suited to slow cooking. So it has good fat on it and will break down into that lovely soft meat that you need for biryani. And then that's a recipe that I ate loads of biryani traveling through India, really trying to find sort of the best one I could find. And that one was sort of similar a little bit to a biryani that I had in Lucknow, which is in North India. So it's good deep yogurt and almonds and lots of rose water and
cumin,
and it's sort of deep and strong, but it's also aromatic and pretty.
Oh, it was beautiful.
Now talk to us about a few of the dishes that we missed.
My menu changes every day. Some of the things that are often on there is a selection of Sri Lankan curries that you'll have with rice. So at the moment we're making a kiri hodi, which is a brothy potato curry, a sort of raw coconut salad-y type thing, a little bit like a sambal, and pickles and a quick-cooked spinach. And so that's really vibrant and colourful and all different things. But then
very simple and very kind of pared back. So at the moment, the first of the British asparagus has arrived, which is so late this year, but I mean, it's always nice to see it. We know it's such a delight to see it when it arrives. And we're just grilling that over charcoal, and then we've made a Spanish almond and paprika and vinegar sauce called romesco, and which goes wonderfully well. So it's for me, I suppose, what I like to do is look at the ingredient and then don't feel sort of constrained by where the recipe I want to make comes from. I mean, still give it its context and its story, but allow it to... So the Spanish sauce is fantastic. Or later in the year, the asparagus might go into a Szechuan dish or something like that.
Well, you certainly are adventurous.
Yeah.
And I think that makes it a very exciting place to dine. And as I said, it's pleasant as an environment. The servers are very cheerful and knowledgeable, and we had a really nice time.
Oh, good. I'm so glad to hear that.
How does okra go over in the UK? I'm looking at an old menu here that has okra, pakora, chaat, masala.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. You know, people worry about okra that it's slimy. I don't really mind a little bit of slime, but that recipe, the okra is chopped quite small, then it's put into a chickpea flour batter that's sort of quite delicately spiced, and then deep fried. And then that sort of deep fried pakora, sort of bhaji type thing, goes into a really vibrant Indian salad with chopped pineapples and tomatoes and cucumbers and another spice mix and some crunchy chickpeas.
A couple more things. Are you still doing the hen-dive scallops?
No, they're off at the moment.
They're off, okay.
The weather's been pretty bad in Scotland, so the guys haven't been going out on the boats. But whenever they get them, they call me and I always take some.
Sure. And then you've got a Spanish-sounding fish stew called zarzuela.
Yes, that's lovely. So that make a saffron broth, and then we get as many different kinds of wonderful fish we can. So it might be cod and bream and bass and clams and mussels. And we'll bake it in the oven, and we put on top of it what's called a picado. And in Spanish cooking, a picado is quite important in that it sort of finishes something, so it's quite punchy, and in this case it's quite crunchy. It's almonds and breadcrumbs and parsley and garlic and saffron all pounded together, and that goes on top of this sort of slightly brothy fish stew, and it gets baked in the oven. Zarzuela actually in Spain is like an operetta, a sort of variety show.
Uh-huh.
Singing funny songs, so it's a great name for that dish.
For those who eat dessert, which we didn't, what would be the dessert that you'd be recommending today?
We have a few. There's a Syrian cake that I really love, which is pistachio with quite a lot of nutmeg in it. It has a kind of biscuity base. It's an interesting recipe. It's in my most recent book. And what you do is, you know, when you're making a cake, you sort of cream butter and sugar together normally, and then you add nuts. But then with this one, what you do is you take half of the mix out at that point. I mean, you press that into the base of the tin so that it becomes a sort of biscuity base, and then the rest of it you mix with eggs and a raisin agent so that the top of it is kind of cakey. It's a really wonderful recipe that I came across in Syria, that you have to use those really young, bright green pistachios.
And just to show, Auntie hasn't had a chance to look in as carefully in detail at this old menu, which is where the print is very small. But one of our very favourite things in Italy are called Nespoli. Or Nespoli.
Yes, I love Nespoli.
Here's Nespoli on his menu.
Yes, well, they're sort of the first of the fruits to really come into season in Europe. So you're always kind of, you have this long winter, and there's rhubarb, which I love, but God, you can get sick of rhubarb. And then the Nespoli arrives, and it's the first stone fruit, and it's the beginning of those fruits, and then next will be the apricots, and then you'll have a peach, a wonderful peach. So I'm always delighted to see the Nespoli. I like them in Italy.
What do you call it?
And in Spain, they call them. Well, we don't really have a name. They don't really grow there. Sometimes they get called Japanese loquats. They like them in Japan as well. And in Spain, they're called nisperos. And in France, they're called nef, which, and they don't really eat them. There's an expression in France when they say there's only nef. That means, you know, there's nothing. We haven't got anything. We've only got those nests on the tree.
Oh, my goodness.
it's the fruit of what kind of a medlar tree is what it is. And I never...
It's similar to a medlar, but we have an English medlar that it is quite different to the Nestle.
Well,
they're much more apple-y.
Well, we always get them in Italy, of course, and it wasn't, I didn't know about the brown spots on them until I saw them made up as marzipan. And then I realized that they were not spoiled, but they were intricately related to the species.
Yes, exactly.
We love Doc's Doc Kitchen, and it's been great talking to you as well.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to meet you and listeners. This is a fascinating place where you'll be sure to get a surprise, and 99% of the time, I'm sure it's going to be a wonderful surprise. So, Stevie, thank you so much for joining us today, and we wish you continued success with Doc Kitchen.
Thank you so much, and you guys as well. It's been great to meet you, and I hope you have a really good trip.
Thank you so much,
Stevie. Bye-bye.
Great. Thank you. Goodbye.
One thing I forgot to mention ahead of the interview is that Stevie was best young chef in England several years ago, and we certainly understood why when we enjoyed lunch at his restaurant. And now, after another break, yet another spicy alternative for London.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and I think that with the next guest, Sri Ram, he will tell us about his restaurant, and you'll understand, and we're talking about Quilon, of course, you'll understand that when we say spicy, we're not talking about mouth-numbing heat. We're talking about flavors, and this restaurant really takes this skill to the absolute limits.
The interesting thing is that we discovered that in the few days after we were at Koya, the restaurant we introduced us two segments ago, Sriram Ela from Quilon went to have lunch at Koya. We had written him recommending that he go there, and he said, "Oh, I was there just last week, and I really thought it was wonderful." And perhaps it's not surprising since the chef at Koya is of Indian extraction, but it's really interesting to see both the Peruvian restaurant and an Indian restaurant using spices so incredibly skillfully.
Oh, yeah.
And I think we forgot to mention when we're talking about Koya that we think of Peru as having 10,000 varieties of potatoes, but they also have almost 10,000 varieties of peppers.
And ceviche, yeah.
And the same is true in India, where regionally there are peppers and there are peppers and there are peppers. And the southwestern coast of India, which is where the
Sriram.
Sriram, it's where his family was from, although he was raised in Mumbai, he said.
Yeah, well.
But he said that.
Well, he talks about that in the interview.
What's in the larder will fascinate you, and what would be on your plate when you go there should fascinate you as well.
Sriram Ayler has spent pretty much his whole life involved with food. I'm not exaggerating, Sriram, am I?
I would believe so. At least I've spent most beginning of my life eating and then cooking, so yes.
Exactly, yeah.
In a way.
And you trained as a chef in India, and you're
correct.
From where in India?
My parents are from Kerala. I am born and brought up in Bombay.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And I spent last part of my working life in Bangalore and London.
A lot of the dishes that you specialize in come from this region, Kerala.
Yes, coast of India. So we do food from Kerala, Karwar, Goa, Mangalore, that region. The southwest coast of India.
And what are the main characteristics of that sort of cuisine?
It's got, actually that part is the spice bowl of India in a way, because the best cardamom, the best cinnamon, all that comes from that region. Chilies are grown in the south of India, so you get, and there is a lot of fresh coconut, a lot of curry leaf, you know, so a lot of herbs, spices, all that. And so what happens is they're all very fresh, they're very subtle, and also because it is a coast, you have a lot of fish and seafood, you know.
Yes.
And the cooking is more of broiling, boiling, braising, stewing, grilling. It's lighter, nicer, healthier.
It's very sophisticated food. Now, people always know that, or always think that if you want to go to a good Indian restaurant in London, that you end up, generally speaking, in curry houses, which... this is not a curry house. You, in fact, own two restaurants, Quilon and what is the other one called?
Bombay Brasserie.
Bombay Brasserie.
Okay. And the difference between your kind of, what we call it, sophisticated, subtle cooking and the average curry houses you encounter in London is so enormous that I don't even know how to explain it to our listeners. I can just say that all I have to do is think the word Quilon and I immediately am hungry.
See, firstly, 96% of so-called curry houses are not even Indian to begin with.
No, they're Anglo-Saxon.
So I think there is a kind of a little bit of, it's not the correct thing. Anyway, so slowly now there are many more good Indian restaurants opening in and around London. So choice is increasing, and also the kind of cuisine that restaurants have started presenting is becoming more sophisticated, more refined,
yeah,
and more true to India.
Now, I think I mentioned to you when we were in that I have a restaurateur friend here in the States who's Indian, and he says that you can't get any real Indian food if you're not in someone's home. But you proved that wrong.
See, I think when you want to have Indian food outside India, I think London is the best place to come. And I think, yes, Quilon, Bombay Brasserie, we do. Quilon and Bombay Brasserie, we do. That is real true to the region, true to India. And there are other restaurants too. So, yes, the whole idea is to give you an experience that is as close as possible to back home.
Now, yeah, you got the job of doing that from a very large and sophisticated, I guess, hotel group called the Taj Group.
Yes.
And that's how you got to London. They said, please go to London and establish for us the kind of fine Indian dining that we want people to enjoy.
That's correct. See, as a company, you know what happened is the Taj set up the Bombay Brasserie 35, 36 years back, and it was the first real sophisticated Indian restaurant in London then.
I see.
So because the North Indian food itself was not in the right perspective, so we did that with Bombay Brasserie. Then what happened is a lot of other restaurants opened up similar, almost a similar style, you know, of food. So we said, because people were not taking it to the next level, we said, now let us also present India, different parts of India, because Indian cuisine, as you may know, yeah, varies from state to state, even within the state, it varies from one area to the other. So it's very complicated, sophisticated, very different. So we said, let us do South because nobody is doing it. So that's how we did the Southwest Coast.
Uh-huh.
And the other reason of doing it is also because we have a restaurant called the Karavali, which I was part of setting up in Bangalore, which is now 23 years old. And when we set that up, that was a Southwest Coast food restaurant, and it kind of caught Southern Indian food to a sophisticated level in India itself. So we said, now let us do a restaurant inspired by Karavali in London, and that's how Quilon was born.
Now, I mean, to begin with, place is drop-dead gorgeous. I mean, it is so beautifully designed and tranquil. Was that one of your goals?
Yes.
See,
the whole idea of everything about Quilon that we do here, the idea is, even like the interior, for example, it's all inspired by the West Coast. We have taken elements of the West Coast and used those elements in a contemporary way to do the interior. And even so goes with the food that we do. It is plated in a very simple but clean fashion, which we believe looks nice. And also it is cooked in the best ingredient is bought. It is done properly the way it should be done. Wherever we think the spices are not good enough here, we import it ourselves. And so the whole idea is to keep everything inspired and true to its origin, but with a little twist so that it is relevant to where we are.
And it's also, listeners, let's be assured that you understand that this is very fine dining.
Oh, yes.
There's no question about that. So it's an intersection of Southwest Indian food with a goal of setting a mean fine dining table.
Oh, it's elegant. The decor is elegant. The food is elegant. I was shocked. I didn't even know India made fine wines. Tell us a little bit about that.
It is in the last, the whole winemaking thing, India has been flirting with it for the last 20, 25 years, but in the last 15 years, it has become serious industry, and there are a lot of winemakers, and a lot of them have tried to experiment with it, create new styles, even use classical
grapes like a Sauvignon or a Cabernet or whatever, and try to bring them to levels that are internationally accepted. And there are regions in India like Nasik, Bangalore, so there are areas that have the weather, the soil, everything that is good to grow grapes. So yes, so we have seen growth. But having said all that, to just put Indian wine in perspective, you know, firstly, you know, now it is being sold all over the world. Indian wine is being even sold in France and London and even in America, which is a good sign. But also Indian, drinking of wine in India itself is growing. But the point is, there is the amount of wine that India consumes in a year, England consumes during Christmas. So, it is still, still an infant industry, but it is growing very quickly and it's maturing very quickly. So I think there is some very, very good wine that is served, and some of the wines that we have on our list, for example, we do a list from growers, you know, the Reserva Shiraz, and it's a very, very good wine. I think it's very good. It's very well made, and it is one of my favorites out of India. It's a fantastic wine, and there are others who are doing that too.
Now, this was the wine. This is the wine you selected for us, man. Let's not forget. We need to now talk about the wonderful dishes that you served for us, because we just said, Sriram, we have no idea what to eat. Just tell us what we should eat. Bring it. So why don't you go through the things you brought us,
Peter? What happens is at the Quinlan, generally when people come. And our guests come, you know, our team members, they talk to the guests, understand if they've been with us before. If not, they explain what it is. And then we generally try to take charge of ordering, simply because to make the experience the way we think will be the best to enjoy our food. And so we did exactly that with you. So, for example, we gave you a small portion of scallop in the appetizer platter, in a few things on a single platter where we had grilled scallops, you know. With a mango and chili
We had different sauces.
Yeah, so even before that, yes, we served you some papads with some coconut and coriander chutney. We served an onion and tomato chutney. We also served you a lemon and chili chutney. We served you a ginger and a jaggery chutney and a garlic and chili pickle.
Beautiful.
And then we had that wonderful, you just called it chopped lamb.
What was that?
Yes,
tell
the kottu lamb. So the kottu lamb is basically, you know, you take chunks of lamb and then you put all the spices and the onion and everything on a griddle plate. You cook and you cook the lamb. And when you cook, you also mince it with sharp knife-like things. So it's cooking and also it's getting minced at the same time. And then it is straight away served from the griddle plate to the plate. And then you get, so That's actually street food back home, and it's simple but very nice. We also served you sukha chicken, which is basically, because the south of India does not have tandoor like the north has, a lot of things get done on a griddle plate, you know. Basically, this is the sukha chicken is an answer to the chicken tikka that you get in the north, basically marinated chicken that is cooked on a griddle plate very quickly, and it was served with some coriander curry leaf chutney, which was served with it. So that's what you had for start. And again, in the main course, we did baked black cod.
Oh, right, that was gorgeous.
Our creation here.
Yeah, that's a distinctly un-Indian fish.
Yes, it is. You know, that is inspired by the Japanese black cod, miso black cod. So once when I was having dinner with a friend of mine in one of the Japanese restaurants, I just said, this fish is beautiful, and I said, we need to give it Indian treatment, and that's what we did. So we took the same black cod, and we used tamarind, and we used jaggery, and we used fenugreek, chili, and all that, marinated it, and baked it. So the idea was, see, one thing that we try and do in Quilon is we are very true to what we do, and what I mean by that is we use ingredients, as in when I say ingredients, spices and herbs, that is from the west coast, not just from India, but from the southwest coast of India. So whenever we try and create a new dish, we keep that as the rule of creation, so that it's part of the repertoire that we create. So that is the idea, and that is how black cod was created. And then we served you a chicken curry, which is called the Mangalore chicken curry. It is traditionally from Mangalore, and it is, and for example, Mangalore grows its own chilies, and the chilies are called berge. So we actually import the chilies ourselves directly from there, berge chilies, to make that curry. And that goes very well with bread, like the Malabar paratha and rice. So it's a very popular dish. And
now, did we have dessert? I can't remember. I think we probably said no.
The rose ice cream we must have given you.
Okay, we probably did. Now, listeners, here's the important stuff you need to know. The website is www.quilon, that's Q-U-I-L-O-N, .co.uk. The location is 10 minutes walk from Parliament Square, probably 15 minutes walk from Buckingham Palace, and very close to Victoria Station, on an amazingly quiet street where you wouldn't expect to find a wonderful restaurant and a magnificent hotel, of which you're a part, called the Taj Hotel. Anything else they need to know, Shriram? Our listeners need to know, or do we just say go?
Yeah, I think that's good enough. And yeah, we would love to welcome your listeners to
make sure they make a reservation, because you get very busy. I mean, it's
yes, we do.
It's larger than I thought it was, actually. How many seats do you have?
80. We have 80.
Yeah, and they're filled. So everybody should make a reservation. And well, we love it. And I wish we were back having dinner with you again.
Thank you. I look forward to seeing you both in London.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Bye.
And we'll be back with a rather different story right after this short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And now we have a real change of pace.
Well, as Peter just said, and I repeat, it's not every day that you have a 150th anniversary, but that's what's happening to Beyer Corp. And we have the Parkhurst Dining Group chef, Jeff Sinseline. And Jeff, it's so complicated. Why don't you explain how this event is unfolding?
Well, the powers to be within the headquarters of Beyer in Germany decided to have a global celebration surrounding their 150th anniversary, the centerpiece being a lunch for all 110,000 peoples worldwide, and the main portion of that was a meal that I helped provide the recipes in preparation for.
Don't you think that it's significant that this is the way a major international corporation chooses to celebrate?
I think it's very unique. It'd be much easier to produce a commemorative coffee mug and ship them out across the globe and say, thanks.
Right. And how many chefs are involved in preparing this and the menu for this event?
Well, back in October and November, they solicited for applications to be a part of this international planning committee for the chefs across the globe. I was fortunate enough to be accepted along with four other colleagues.
And are all these people, now I mean, you are involved because you are contract caterers to Beyer USA in Pittsburgh. And
correct.
You work Parkhurst Dining, which is an ancillary company to Eaton Park, right?
Correct. Eaton Park Hospitality Group is our parent company.
Which I love. That's the people with the smiley cookies, and I love the Broadhurst.
Yeah, smiley cookies and smiley people.
Okay. And I'm going to shock you by telling you that I actually remember the original drive-in on, what was that boulevard? Was it Washington Boulevard?
I don't know.
Anyhow.
It's not there anymore, I guess.
Well, certainly not there anymore. I think they had car hops, didn't they?
They did. That was the whole idea.
Yeah, Eaton Park, that's it. All right. Well, let's not get into that, because then we'll start talking about age, and I don't want to do that. Okay, so you have how many people are you feeding with this luncheon?
Well, at our location here in Robinson, we're preparing a meal for 1,500 individuals.
Okay.
And here in the Pittsburgh area at some Beyer Healthcare site and other locations, our total meal service is over 3,200.
Okay, and worldwide it's 100 and what?
over 110,000.
You didn't set it up so that everybody lifts their forks at the same time, I guess.
Well, we could try, but that would involve a lot of midnight service.
so you've got people, essentially, they kicked off lunch at the same time, but on the local time clock wherever they were.
Yeah, instead of just lifting a fork simultaneously, think of it as the wave going across the globe with the forks.
There you go. And headquarters, I guess, in Leverkusen, in Germany, has probably had the most people in a single place, I guess, right?
I haven't looked into that. I know that our location here in Robinson is the largest in the United States.
Oh, is it really?
Yes.
Okay.
But you've got plants all over the United States.
Correct.
You have operations in the Kansas City area and all kinds of other places.
I've spoken with folks in about 6 different states and helping them put together their menus.
This is complicated, isn't it?
How was it organized in places where they don't have a service like yours?
Well, within the recipe book and the celebration guidelines, they also laid out guidelines for contracting independent caterers.
Okay.
And to assist them also, since they do have many production facilities that run 3 shifts, in preparing lunch boxes, as they call them, that can be prepared and reheated so that everyone has the same experience.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that's great. So each location, if they didn't have a catering facility on site, they contracted one just for today.
Correct. We actually have a location in West Virginia, one of our colleges, that's going to be catering a production facility in New Martinsville, West Virginia, for 240 of their folks.
And there's noise behind you because you're so in control. I can't believe you're so calm and in control because you're partway through lunch. Have they got the main course yet?
For lunch, well, we serve lunch until about 1:30, so we're good.
This isn't the main event, rather.
Oh, no.
No.
Oh, it's not today.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was...
No, that happens on the 18th, isn't it?
That's right. My mistake, of course.
Okay, so anyhow, so that
so
question,
no one,
you
so
can
no wonder he's,
that
no
one.
Wonder he's so calm.
No wonder he's so calm. You're not going to be that calm when you're in the midst of serving all these people. What are you going to do? How are you going to handle that?
Very carefully. No, it's all in the planning and preparation. Our facility here isn't nearly as large as you'd like for one that would serve this many people on a regular basis. So we're reaching out to some of our sister locations here in the area. They're going to help us with staffing and some base production and chopping and preparation, and then we'll put all the components together here and serve it.
All right, now what is on the menu, essentially? First, tell us your course.
Well, that was the only item that the local team here insisted that the 2 items that I contributed to the menu be served at our meal, of course. One of the appetizers that I produced was an Israeli couscous salad with cinnamon almonds.
Oh, yes, that sounded good. I did read that, yes.
Yeah, not an indigenous American dish, but something that meets the requirements of global availability and acceptance with ingredients that can be easily sourced. So it's a nice combination, more northern African Mediterranean than American for sure,
yeah.
But something that should be easy to execute and well-received just about anywhere.
So, and what's the second dish?
The other item of mine on the menu is a mint-kissed strawberry lemonade, a nice summertime drink being in the beginnings of summer here in the state. The strawberries we'll be getting from a local farm, so it helps support our local initiatives. And the requirements for a non-alcoholic cocktail, I thought that was a nice item, and they did too.
Right. And what are there other items in the menu that you find interesting that are going to be served this around the globe?
Yeah, the Chinese gentleman, we're going to be making his dish of Kung Pao chicken.
Oh, okay.
Which I found interesting because the execution of that dish is a little different than you might typically suspect here with the Americanized Chinese.
Oh, I'm sure it's probably no resemblance whatsoever to the authentic version, right?
It resembles, but the way the sauce in it comes together is certainly different than we would have done with our European and American training.
And anything else interesting?
The other item we're serving is a orange salmon. Came from Lady Chef Sylvia in Mexico City, which is, it's a nice dish. It's technically a poached or steamed dish where the salmon is baked with julienne fresh vegetables and an orange broth in the oven, and you open it up right there in front of the customers and start serving it, and it comes out quite moist and tender, and it's very aromatic. It's a real nice dish for this many people.
I think that it's a very exciting event, and I think that the employees have to be thrilled that they get, instead of a mug, that they get a good meal. And the memories of it coming through the recipe book that they'll be have in hand as well. And again, I think that the Parkhurst Dining is something to note of. Who are some of your other, just off the top of your head, clients? I mean, here, for example.
Well, some of our current clients here in the Pittsburgh market. PNC Bank has a number of locations with us here and outside of the area. Highmark, we cater at the Highmark building downtown. A couple of special venues, the Carnegie Science Center and Carnegie Museums of Pittsburgh and Oakland.
Yes.
They're a real special place for us.
Yeah, and you get a lot of special events through that, too.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. That is we get to reach out to a lot of people through those special venues. Some of our college partners in the area include Chatham University, Robert Morris University, Washington and Jefferson College, and our latest partner is Duquesne University.
Great. Congratulations on that account.
And not to forget Google.
Oh, yep. Google's out there, too. Can't forget them. They are not the largest in population, but they get to do some spectacular things, some very creative things out there. I'm jealous sometimes.
Yeah, well, they're actually expanding, I understand, but
yes.
Locally.
Yes, they're definitely on the growth.
You know, I can't help but mentioning that there are often many citations of one of the best-run family businesses in this country for Eaton Park Dining. And it's a family business. And just off the top of your head, why do you think it's so well run?
Well, it starts at the top. Having worked with the Broadhurst for a number of years, they're certainly well invested personally and professionally in the company, and it starts there, and it infects itself through the whole organization, where they really do care about people, and that smile you see on the cookie is the smile they want to put on the face of their team members and coworkers first and foremost.
And they're venturing into fine dining called in Shenley Park, the Porch.
The Porch, yes. Six Pen Kitchen's been around for seven, 8 years now. That was their first venture into kind of an upscale independent restaurant in the Porch, and they're opening up some smaller versions, more urban versions of Eaton Park called Hello Bistro.
Hello Bistro, yes, the one I was trying to think of. Well,
oh, yeah.
You have a whole field of where you can exercise your talent and ability and expand along with this wonderful corporation.
Absolutely. I've been here for 14 years for a reason.
Okay, Jeff.
and happy birthday, Bayer.
Yes.
Happy birthday, Bayer USA. And
yes.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, no problem. It's my pleasure.
Thanks, Jeff.
And we'll be back with a final segment right after this break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And next up, a charming memoir of wonderful childhood trips to France with, I might say, delicious recipes. We're going to be talking to Sarah Remington about her experiences, and the book is entitled Paris to Provence. Well, we have half a team here, but a good half, I think. We have Sarah Remington, who with her friend, or partner, I guess, in a way, in writing the book, I mean, Ethel Brennan, wrote Paris to Provence, which is subtitled, and it is, about childhood memories of food and France. It's a very unusual situation, Sarah, that you should find somebody who's, she's 10 years older, actually, Ethel?
She is, and we actually started working together on different photography projects and different cookbooks, and she is a stylist, and she's a writer as well, and I am a photographer, and we just started working together, and we worked together so well, and we were always creative, we always didn't have to check in with each other as much as I usually do, and anyway, through the years of working together, on one of the sets, we just started talking about our childhoods together in France, and she had a very similar experience in that she spent her summers with her family in France, driving from Paris to Provence and visiting different cities and exploring different culinary adventures with her parents and her mother's Georgiane Brennan, who wrote A Pig in Provence. And she wrote, among many other books, but A Pig in Provence.
Okay. It took me a minute. I read the introduction, which she wrote to your book, to realize that you were the 2-year-old baby that she moved to France with.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, and she, you
all
know, they,
grown
they
up.
I know exactly. And experience was similar, but also very different in that we went, my parents and my sister and I went on the same, very similar road trips and experienced the same culinary adventures throughout France in the summers. But my parents actually went to school there. My dad went to medical school. My mom went to the Sorbonne for a little while. And they ended up making a lot of friends and visiting those friends and taking us with them through their adventures. And the rest is history. We just explored every summer, and the memories were so strong when Ethel and I first started talking about it on set. It was like we were the same voice, and we were sharing the same ideas and the same memories and finishing each other's sentences. And it was such a cool thing and such a fun thing. And
you sound like you had a really wonderful time. And give us the years we're talking about.
Well,
because I think that makes a difference. I realized that you couldn't have that experience now, neither one of you. But tell us the years.
Yes, exactly. So for me, I was born in 79, so it was early 80s to the late 80s. And then for Ethel, it was, I don't know the dates exactly, but it was about 10 years prior to that. And then up until her age of 17, so she was more in the 70s. And that is correct in that you pointed out it's really hard to do that now, because in that day, that's when, I mean, if we can remember when plane tickets transatlantic were so cheap and you could really travel cheap and stay with friends, and it was not a big thing. And so we had this really great window where we were able to experience these beautiful French memories and these amazing foods that we couldn't really get here without it being too crazy expensive. So we also spent a lot of time just sort of reliving those memories in our older years and talking about them and wanting to bring that about and share it with people in a very poetic way with some recipes. So.
Now, so you think that the countryside experience in France is really so different now?
I don't think it would be a different experience. I think it was just, as a child, you experience things in a completely different level with every sense, the way things smell, the way things taste, the way you interact with people. So going back to the places that we went to when we were children was a completely different experience because of, with age, some of the esoteric qualities that you experience as a kid are kind of gone in a sad way, but then you experience them in an adult way, which you couldn't have experienced as a child. And if that answers your question, yeah, I think it's similar and different in many different ways, but it felt like a magical time. There were a lot of places we went to that didn't have a lot of tourist footprints, so it felt like it was sort of a lot of these places felt very magical and very different and not very explored, and so I felt very lucky to have that.
I wonder now.
So you're saying in some respects tourist hordes have taken over?
Yeah.
So you have to get further and further out of the way?
Exactly. Well, that happens all the time, too, and especially as travel writers or writers in general, you want to find those places that are off the beaten path and no one knows about, but you also want to share them, so you're sort of in a weird space where you want people to understand what you went through and what you loved, but you want to keep it for yourself, too. You don't want anybody else to go there because it's all yours.
You know, I think that anybody who just picks up this book will see that it's, the recipes are great, they are in the story. Are what really makes the book so special, and they're very personal. But I mean, you have a way of tapping into this child that you were that's sort of amazing, too. I mean, I'm looking at my sister and I hid in the tall grass, bugs flying in our ears as we tried to avoid them by shutting our eyes and waving our hands next to our heads. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's just, I don't know how you key into that.
Yeah, it's sort of, I love that you notice those little things, because a lot of, basically, the heart of the book is in the food and the recipes, but branching out from that and talking about the experience of making the food or what we did before we ate or what we did after we ate was just resonated as strong for me as it did for Ethel, as much as the food itself. So everything that happened around what we are going to do that day obviously revolved around eating. Wake up, what are you going to have for breakfast? And then what are you going to do in between breakfast and lunch? And then there's a snack and what happens in between those times, because it's really magical and fun. But we also wanted to write it in a way that wasn't so sort of a, it wasn't telling you how we enjoyed these things and how another person can enjoy these things at this time, but more so how we experienced them as children and almost written in a childlike way, in sort of a run-on sentence way. You know how kids talk and they just sort of come up with ideas and memories and crazy things, and we wanted that to kind of come out in between the recipes.
Well, you did that.
And it was, yeah, and it was, thank you. And it was really funny and seamless because Ethel has such a great voice, and my voice sort of mixed in with hers so much that when we read each other's words, we kind of forgot who wrote what. And there were so many, there were a couple times where we were handing each other work to correct, and I was like, did I write this? Did you write? I can't remember. So the way that we write is very similar. It's very descriptive. It talks a lot about the heightened sense of what we went through, and Ethel just brilliantly put together these beautiful recipes that are so simple. They're not too fussy. They're just very traditional French recipes that, to me, are very easy.
And they're classics. They're real classics.
Yeah, they're very classic, and they're what we remember. We didn't want to add too much to them. We didn't want to pretend we were something we weren't. It was more of a diary of our adventures, culinary adventures. So.
Yeah, well, it's not surprising that the photographs and the images are so stunning, because, I mean, here you have a writer and prop artist as well as a writer and photographer. But even beyond that, I mean, I'm looking at this photograph of the little snuggly sleeping pigs.
Oh, I love that one.
I do, too. You and I are probably in the same wavelength, too.
It's so funny. You read one of my favorite little excerpts, too, about the bugs, and that was one of my favorite photos of the pigs. So, yeah, and you know what was so great about that is that we kind of shot and wrote the book the way that we experience these stories, but in an adult sense. So, for example, that photo was taken when Ethel, Georgianne, and I visited a goat farm, and there were some pigs just sleeping together in this barn. I was sort of wandering around the grounds, and all of a sudden I turn around, and there's these pigs looking so snuggly and warm and cute. And there's nothing worse than showing a picture of a pig, because there's always going to be a recipe for pork or something later on, and then seeing its eyes or something where it has this more human quality. But I love that one because you just see the shape of their bodies, and it's almost a little abstract. And that day was really fun, too, because we actually followed these goats through the fields while they grazed, and they were just stomping on these just huge tufts of thyme and rosemary, and the area smelled amazing. I will never forget that. It was just a really amazing, beautiful smell. And, yeah, it was just great. So that was one of my favorite photos as well.
There were two things I particularly wanted to ask you about, because they were very important to you at the time that you were in France exploring when you were children, and I'm wondering the extent to which you think that these two things, and I'll give them to you one at a time, whether they're still there, genuine and the same, or whether somehow they've changed. The first is the cafe that's everywhere, where you say, essentially, you sit down at the cafe and it's like you're in a time capsule.
Right.
There's the rest of the world is going on around you, but you're ignoring it, and you're in almost a surreal experience of being separated from the rest of the world. And is the French cafe still like that or not?
It certainly is. It always, what baffles me about the cafe experience is that when you go to France, it seems like the cafes, there's one every 20 feet, and they always seem to be filled with people. And always, any time of day during the week, it seems like, just like, wow, this is such a huge experience of everyday life. There's always people there. And I think it's really important to uphold the tradition of the cafe through the years, because that is just, it's a way of life, and you can't really replicate it. And there are some of those things that you go into very touristy areas and they replicate a quote-unquote French cafe and have everything seemingly what it would be like if it wasn't, I guess, a Las Vegas version of a Paris cafe, kind of a fake thing. But there's always those really small, beautiful cafes in little alleyways that have five old men just standing at the bar and chatting about everything. And those are always going to be around, and they're always going to have the same sort of smell and feel, and just everything about them is going to have that traditional French cafe that will never go away, because it's such a huge part of life.
Now, here's the second. Obviously, there's a different word for it in French, and I've forgotten what it is. But I remember that as we toured France several years in a row in the mid-1990s, full parking lot tests still work. If you drove by a truck stop and there were no cars in the parking lot, you didn't go there. And if you saw one where the parking lot was filled with trucks and other cars and you stopped, you could be guaranteed to get a great meal. It worked for us, and I'm wondering if it still does.
Oh, yeah. No, that's great. And, you know, Ethel actually knows, she wrote that little bit about the truck stops, and she has more experience with those than I do. But from what she's told me, what the few times I remember, it's some of the best French, traditional French food that you can get. It's like comfort food. It's real good comfort food, and it's just beautiful. And yeah, and those are still there too. Just like, I don't think you can compare them to any real truck stops in the U.S. because those are kind of silly at this point. There's not a lot going on there. But there's something about them. There's obviously truckers have been driving for days and days, and having a home-cooked meal is so important. So I think they've put a lot of love and soul into those meals, and that's why they tasted so good and why we remember them so well.
There's one that I can remember. I think I could probably drive there right now. In fact, it's very close to that place. I think it's Motril or something like that, where they built this truly hideous highway flyover that goes across a pristine valley, and it's right near the caves where the Roquefort cheese is made.
We had
lunch at this place, and the final course, which was Roquefort cheese, I think it was a 10-franc plate of cheese. 10 francs was everything we paid for lunch.
Oh my gosh!
And the owner thought we were interviewing him to write a book about France.
I don't know why.
And he kept on asking us.
My French is.
he kept on writing to us, because this is way before email, asking us when we were going to write this book about truck stops in France.
I think that's a brilliant idea. Actually, we should do that together. I mean, it's really because sometimes the most simple food is the best food, the most beautiful comfort food that you remember as a kid, or just when you're weary from traveling or what have you. Those are the best memories, and you don't even have to try that hard, because you don't have to try with special sauces or ingredients that are hard to find. It's just real, true, good French food. And there are some places, and I remember a few times we traveled through Italy doing that too, and there would be 3-course meals in the middle of the day. No wonder why everybody took a nap afterwards, but just so good. It's gone are the thoughts of having a soggy hamburger in a paper wrapper or something. But I'm sure, you know, but it was great. And Ethel, again, she has such great stories about that too, and there's a little excerpt in the book about the specific truck stops in there too. But I'm glad you have that memory. That's so great. And that's a brilliant idea, a French truck stop book.
Go ahead.
Good. Well, if you decide to go ahead with it, let us know. We'll come with you. We'll do it with all
of
us together.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, all the way from Paris on the left coast.
And I think that everybody would find comfort in this book, too, but also the nostalgia is just, it's vibrant, so it's not sleepy time comfort kind of.
Thank you so much. I know it's very, we had an amazing, I could talk about it for a long time, and I'm sure we could chat about French food for a long time, too, but it was quite a fun experience, and I hope to see more books like that on the market too, where there's a lot of nostalgia and memories involved rather than just recipes and descriptions. I think it really elevates the food to a different level.
Well, please give our regards to your partner in crime. And,
okay, well, I will do that.
I have this feeling there's going to be another book coming out, which we're going to talk to you about before a couple of years are over, I'm sure.
I hope so. We work together really well, so I think it'll be I know it'll be a home run.
So what do we say? Au revoir and bonne chance.
Yeah.
Bonne chance.
Yeah,
yes, bon chance. I'm sorry. I'm glad I didn't have to speak my French. It's a little rusty right now. But.
Well, you can imagine how good mine is if they thought I was writing a book on truck stop food. Got me there. Okay, Sarah Remington. The book is Paris to Provence, and I think this is the kind of book that you could read, you want to read, and you could also find a great gift book. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was really a pleasure talking with you both.
And that's all we have for this week's program. We'll look forward to you joining us same time, same place next week, when we'll have more adventures with the world of food, wine, and travel with Anne and Peter Hague of On the Menu Radio. And until then,
bye-bye.